little that they need. And we have had even a family who was paying $21 a month for insurance. When we tried to investigate the book, the agent was one step ahead of us and took the book from the family and changed the $21 to $2.10.
Which is what it should have been in the first place?
Right. So we had no way of proving anything.
Well, how do you cope with some of these problems?
Well, we try to educate the people when they come in that they should not buy except from reputable firms, and that if they're not sure, they should budget with some consumer protection agency.
And before buying appliances or something like that, to check with someone to make sure it's a
good deal. That's right, Tommy. Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. We had on another program a guest from the National Alliance of Businessmen who points out the very basic fact that good business really involves a social sense and caring for people, and that if you're dealing with a good firm, then everybody's going to benefit.
That's right.
It's a hard lesson to get across.
It is.
How can the poor help themselves? I know the last thing you want to do is be paternalistic or maternalistic, as the case may be.
Only through our educating them towards helping themselves. They have to be led step by step, and with some of them, it's a case of starting way back in teaching them how to read a calendar and how to use a clock. It's as simple as that with some cases. With other cases, they're ready for the advanced step almost when they come to us, but some necessity has caused them to be thrown into a dilemma and they come into us. But most of the cases that come to us have been caught in the great trap of the welfare system.
How much did you know about the problems when you first started?
Very little, except that the poor needed a friend.
And you sort of learned along with them.
That's right.
Mm. The idea of getting people on a permanent commitment, I think, is one of your biggest problems. What can somebody get out of it? Why should somebody go and work with you? What results will derive?
It's a tremendous challenge, and there are great problems to be solved. And each time that you can give hope to another family, money couldn't buy what you get from that.
Are you happier now doing this than you ever were?
Oh, I've never been so happy.
You don't know where the next meal is coming from sometimes.
That's true, but on the other hand, that's what the poor don't know. And I would never know what they're talking about if I didn't go through the same experience.
What can people in our audience do to assist the persons in situations like you or to get more information from you?
They can finance such dedicated people who want to help the poor without
strings.
Yes, without strings, definitely, because you have to live with the poor to understand what the next step is. They also can give their time. We are, as I say, looking desperately for people who really want to help solve the problem and want to make this a life work.
And not just kind of a dilettante thing that might enable them to satisfy their conscience, but not get into the problem.
That's right.
The hardest thing in the world, I guess, is to find people like that, and yet the need for them to do it is greater than ever. Well, you're certainly an inspiration to me, Mae Gintling, and I thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Pleasure. ...chariots and drowning the soldiers. The children of Israel now are free. They're safe from their foes. They'd gladly stay right here by the Red Sea and keep on singing forever, but Moses knows better. They have a long way to go. There are many mouths to feed, and they must move on. So, when the song of praise is ended, he gives orders for the caravan to be formed and to make ready to start at once on its journey. And 6 weeks after leaving Egypt, they came into the wilderness of Sin, about 100 miles down the peninsula of Sinai. Now, this was a dry, barren, rocky country with little pasture for the cattle and no place to grow food. Some of them muttered, "What a place, what a place. Why has he brought us here? If we had gone north instead of south, we'd have been in Canaan by now. What does he think we're going to grow here?" asked one of the farmers. "How does he think we're going to keep our cattle alive on this poor scrubland?" asked another. It was so silly a thing for them to say. But they had been slaves so long they didn't really know any better. Even though they had seen God do many wonderful things for them, they still did not understand him, did not trust him. Moses told God what the people were saying, asked him what he should do, and God promised that he would rain bread from heaven. And that evening, just as the people were wondering what they would eat, thousands of birds flew into the camp. They were quail. They flew so low that it was easy to catch them. And everybody had a good supper. Some perhaps remembered to thank God for looking after them once more. But what about breakfast? There were no stores where they might go and buy shredded wheat or cornflakes. There was no milkman to leave milk outside the tent. What sort of food would God provide in the morning, many wondered. Would he send quail again? No, indeed. Instead, he sent something quite different. Early the next morning, as soon as the dew was gone, behold, upon the face of the wilderness, there lay a small thing, as small as the frost on the ground, and when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it's manna. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord hath given you to eat. For the next 40 years, this was their main source of food. No longer worried about food, Israel journeyed on down the peninsula of Sinai. But there were other problems to be solved. This time from the people of Amalek, who did not like to have the Israelites passing through their country. Anyhow, their soldiers swooped down out of the mountains one day, taking Israel quite by surprise. But they were quickly defeated, thanks to a young man named Joshua, who led the men of Israel into battle. Moses watched this fight from a hilltop with Aaron and Hur. After a while, these two men noticed that when Moses held up his hands, the soldiers of Israel advanced. But that when he dropped his hands, Amalek prevailed. The soldiers, of course, understood why. They had seen him holding up his hands in prayer to God for them all day long, just as though he'd been holding a banner to inspire them. 3 months after the children of Israel had been delivered from Egyptian bondage, they were encamped not in Canaan, but in a very hot desert in the shadow of Mount Sinai. God had not brought the children of Israel out of Egypt by such wonderful deliverance just so they could be like other nations. They were to be totally different. Someday through them would come Jesus, the Savior of the world. Now, if they were to be his witnesses, speaking to others of a holy God, they too must be holy. They must know right from wrong, be willing to choose the right at all times. They must know why sin is hateful and hate it. And because God knew all this, he spoke again from Mount Sinai, making known his will so clearly that there could be no mistake, no misunderstanding about it through all the time to come. Before he did so, however, he told Moses to tell the people to sanctify themselves, to wash their clothes. This was to be a very solemn occasion, which they would not forget as long as they lived. Be ready against the third day, said Moses. For the third day, the Lord will come down in sight of all the people upon Mount Sinai. Well, I tell you, great excitement filled the camp. The mighty God who had saved them from the Egyptians, who'd cut a path through the Red Sea, who'd sent them bread from heaven and water from the rock, this wonderful God of whom they had talked and dreamed from childhood, was coming near to them, so near that they would be able to hear his voice. The days of preparation passed very quickly, and then on the morning of the third day, Mount Sinai became like a volcano. There were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. It was an awesome sight, and the children of Israel trembled with fear. Even the boys and girls stood silent and still as they gazed at the mighty spectacle in wide-eyed wonder. And suddenly, from far up on the mount, out of the fire and the smoke, came a wondrous sound, deep and rich and melodious, the voice of God. And God spake these words, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And then he declared his will in the Ten Commandments. One, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Two, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Three, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Four, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Five, honor thy father and thy mother. Six, thou shalt not kill. Seven, thou shalt not commit adultery. Eight, thou shalt not steal. Nine, thou shalt not bear false witness. 10, thou shalt not covet. And as the people listened, they were greatly moved. That lovely voice speaking with such majesty and power, and yet with such tenderness as they'd never heard before, touched every heart. It made them want to be good. If this was the will of God, they wanted to do it. And they answered together, and they said, all that the Lord hath spoken, we will do. Three times they said this, and I believe they meant it. Well, Moses stayed up on that mountain almost 6 weeks, 40 days, 40 nights. What was he doing all that time? Something very important. He was listening to God. And a very wonderful story he heard. God told Moses that he planned to dwell with Israel, and he wanted them to build a home for him. He said, let them make me a sanctuary. He said that I may dwell among them. Now, it wasn't to be a great palace or a massive temple, just a plain-looking tent or a tabernacle. And yet every part of it was to be made with perfection, and every part was to mean something special and teach some beautiful lesson. And that is why Moses stayed so long. God was so anxious that his tabernacle be made just right that he told him every detail of what he was to do. And Moses must have written it all down, otherwise he could never have remembered so much. Of course, God did not need a dwelling place for himself. But don't you see, the people needed it for their good. The sanctuary was to be portable so that it could be carried from place to place as the children of Israel moved on their way to Canaan. And then God told Moses of the services that were to be carried on in the tabernacle and why animals were to be offered as sacrifices. And so day after day, for 40 days and 40 nights, God told Moses what he wanted him to do, even naming those whom he wanted to be priests and describing the beautiful garments they were to wear. Then on the last day, he gave Moses a very wonderful present. And he gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of communing with him on Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony. These are tables of stone now, written with the finger of God. And the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven upon the tables. And taking them in his arms, Moses began to descend the mountain, his whole being moved by all that had happened. Think of spending 6 weeks alone with God, and then to receive from his hands the priceless tables of his law. He must have felt that he was walking on air as he climbed down the rocky path to where Joshua had been waiting. Then came a terrible shock. Joshua said, there is a noise of war in the camp. Moses stopped and listened. They hurried on, wondering what it could be, and suddenly, as they turned a corner of the trail, they saw what it was. In the midst of the camp was a golden calf, and the children of Israel were dancing around it. The sight was too much for Moses. I can hear him saying, no, 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 not idolatry, not in so short a time. But it was even so. They turned to evil and were consumed by it. The people turned away from the God who had led them to the promised land. Well, terribly disappointed and fiercely angry, Moses cast the precious tables of stone from his hands and smashed them into 1,000 pieces. They went clattering down the mountainside. As Moses strode into the camp, his face aglow from the wonderful time that he had spent with God on the mountain, but his eyes blazing with anger at the sight of that golden calf, the people fell back in awe. Those who had been dancing around the idol ran to find clothes to cover themselves. They were all afraid. Oh, they knew they'd done wrong. Sheepishly, Aaron came forward. What does this mean? Demanded Moses. I left you in charge. What did they do to you that you brought so great sin upon them? And Aaron hardly knew what to say. He said, don't be angry with me. He said, you know these people are set on mischief. They came to me and said, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. It was a lame excuse, but it shows how much weaker Aaron was than Moses. Aaron tried to explain that the people had brought gold to him, and he said, I cast it into the fire and it came out a calf. But an idol doesn't just come out of a fire. Aaron knew better than that. God does not work a miracle to make an idol, so somebody had to make a mold. Somebody had to pour the molten metal. This was no accident. This was deliberate, shameful sin. Light a fire, demanded Moses. And they did. And when it was hot, he threw that golden calf into the fire. He let all the people see their poor little old make-believe God melting away. And when the metal was cool, he called for hammers and he set men to work beating it into paper-thin sheets. The whole camp heard the noise, and everybody watched as the gold spread farther and farther under the endless rain of blows. Bang, clang, clang, clang. Hour after hour, the beating went on. Israel would not soon forget what God had thought of idols. When the gold had been beaten as thin as possible, Moses called for the grinders to be brought. You know, the big stones that the people had used in Egypt to grind their grain. The people watched in amazement. What's he going to do now, grind gold, they asked. Just that. He broke up those paper-thin sheets into pieces. He gave them to the men with the grindstones. Now grind, he commanded. And round went the great stones as the gold was crushed into smaller and smaller fragments. How long shall we grind, asked some of them. Grind on, Moses insisted, and grind they did until the gold of the golden calf had become nothing but fine dust. Probably the people expected that having destroyed the golden calf so completely, Moses would just throw the dust away, but no. He had the grinders gather it up and put it in a howl. And then he strode toward the place where the stream of water poured from the rock at the base of Mount Sinai, and the people followed, frightened now, wondering. And then they saw Moses cast some of the gold dust into the water, then more and more, and the water turned red as it does when gold is mixed with it, and suddenly a cry of alarm arose. Blood, they cried. The water has turned to blood. Drink it, commanded Moses. Everybody, drink it. Well, they came and they stooped and they drank of that blood-red stream. The time had come for a showdown. Things couldn't go on like this. The rebels might take over the camp and spoil all that God was trying to do for Israel. They must be punished severely and at once. So Moses stood at the gate of the camp and cried, who is on the Lord's side? You know, this was an exciting moment. Would anybody answer? Was anybody on the Lord's side? There was a stirring in the camp. People came running, old men, young men. We are, they cried. We're on the Lord's side. The first to come were the sons of Levi. Moses told them to take their swords and to go through the camp from gate to gate, slaying the rebels, sparing not even one. It was a sad hour. 3,000 people were killed, all of whom had passed through the Red Sea and had expected to go on to Canaan. Now they were dead. What a price they were paying for worshiping that golden calf. Things were different in the camp now. Its people had learned their lesson. They were now ready to build a sanctuary that God had told Moses about, but first they were given a test to see how much they really cared for him. Moses asked them to bring God an offering of gold, silver, brass, jewels, spices, oil, fine linens, skins of various kinds. He knew the people had all these things and that they'd taken most of them from the Egyptians during the last night in bondage. He could have reminded them that they would not have any of this wealth if God hadn't delivered them, that it really did belong to him, but he didn't. Instead, he just told them that God wanted only gifts from people who were willing to give. If anybody didn't feel like giving, that was all right with him. They could keep their things. But it must have been a wonderful sight. Everybody bringing what he could, everybody helping the best way he knew how, and all the people, they looked so happy about it. Giving to God made them feel good all over. And when all the gifts were in and piled up around Moses, he told them more of his plans for building the sanctuary. And for the next 3 months, the camp of Israel was a beehive. Everybody busy and happy, having lots to do, made them forget their troubles. In fact, the people were so excited about building that tabernacle that they actually brought more things than they needed. And then day by day, the work went on. Those who were not able to help crowded around to watch as each piece of the tabernacle gradually took shape. Back in their tents at night with no radios, no television sets, and no newspapers to amuse them, they must have talked about what they'd seen during that busy day. The building of the tabernacle. The only thing of interest for hundreds of miles around. No doubt, too, many went to Moses to ask him about the meaning of all this. And this gave him a chance to tell them the story of God's plan of salvation. Well, at last the furniture was moved in, Moses himself making sure that everything was put in the right place. So far as Moses could see, all was in order. He had done exactly according to the pattern God had showed him on the mount. But would it please him? Was he satisfied? And suddenly, as everyone stood watching and wondering, a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. It must have been a tremendous sight. Everybody so thrilled and happy, but the happiest man of all was Moses, because he'd tried so hard, he had done the best that he knew, and now he knew that God was pleased with his leadership. From time to time, the cloud, moving ahead of them, led the entire encampment forward, and soon they found themselves camped less than 150 miles from the promised land of Canaan. Here at last, just about 15 months after their great deliverance from Egypt, they caught their first glimpse of the green hills and the fertile valleys of their future home. My, what excitement in the camp! Can't you imagine mothers hugging their children for joy at the very thought that the hard days in the wilderness with all the heat and the thirst and the weariness would soon be over? Boys and girls shouting as they pictured the land flowing with milk and honey that they had heard their fathers talk about. Fancy, all the milk they could drink, all the honey they could eat. What a wonderful land this must be. And then the people were told to rest in camp while 12 men, one from each tribe, went on ahead to explore the country and find out what would have to be done to get possession of it. These men, every one a ruler, were to spread out all over the place and learn how many people lived there, how strongly their cities were fortified, what sort of food they were growing, and whether there were any trees for lumber. It was a great honor to be chosen for this mission. Each tribe sent its best man. All were heads of the children of Israel. Much depended upon them, more even than they knew. Caleb was sent by the tribe of Judah, Joshua by the tribe of Ephraim. There were 10 others whose names nobody remembers today. As the 12 set forth, there were many goodbyes, good wishes from the thousands who gathered to see them off. And then when at last they had disappeared from view, the rest went back to their tents to await the spies' return. A week passed, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and still there was no word. What could have happened? Could all 12 have been slain by the Canaanites? 4 weeks, 5 weeks, how long the waiting seemed. And then on the 40th day, they came back, and they were loaded down with various kinds of fruit. My, how good it must have seemed to the people who had lived in the wilderness so long. But the object that caught everybody's eye was a huge bunch of grapes. A bunch of grapes so large that it took 2 men to carry it. Now, if this was the produce of Canaan, what a wonderful place it must be. As for the spies, they said they'd just never seen such a country. Surely it floweth with milk and honey. And this, they said, is the fruit of it. Now, up to this moment, everybody'd been happy. Faces were wreathed in smiles. Everybody wanted to go to Canaan at once. But then came the bad news. They told them that there were giants in the land, and that they would never be able to occupy the land of Canaan. What an awful blow to the people. They had thought everything was going to be so easy, just like the falling of the manna from heaven and the quail being blown into them by the wind, but this was terrible. Once more, they began to murmur and complain. Next morning, they were all in a very ugly mood. Seething with hatred for Moses and God, they were full of open rebellion. They cried, "Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt! Would God that we had died in the wilderness!" The disappointment was almost more than they could bear. But at that moment, Caleb and Joshua stood before the raging throng and cried, "The land which we passed through to search it is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us." "Stone them! Stone them!" cried the people. But there were no stones thrown. Suddenly the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle. The angry crowd was hushed. Israel waited, ashamed and afraid, to hear what God would say. And they had not long to wait. And when God spoke, they saw what an awful mistake they had made. They had said that they had wished they had all died in the wilderness. "All right," said God, "then they should have their wish. All those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land. In this wilderness they shall be consumed. And there they shall die." The Lord had spoken. Oh, the heartbreak of it. What a terrible price to pay for failing to trust God. And for the next 40 years, the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. Very little is known of what happened to them. Slowly, wearily, they moved from place to place, staying just long enough for the cattle to eat what little grass they could find, and then on they went again, scorched by the blistering sun, without purpose, and without hope. It was the same old story, the same complaints. Just as soon as things began to go wrong, they wished they were back in Egypt. They were always ready to blame Moses for all their troubles, just as they'd done so many times before. Moses and Aaron turned to God for help. And one day in the desert, their water ran out again. Once again, they began to wail. And God told Moses to gather the children together and to speak to the rock before their eyes, and he would bring forth water for the people. So Moses and Aaron called all of the people to come to the great rock towering above the camp, and standing beneath it, Moses cried out, "Hear now, ye rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock?" That's where he made a great mistake, isn't it? First, he let himself get angry, which no leader should ever do. And second, he let himself claim personal credit for what was a miracle of God. He lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice, and the water did gush forth. The people were overjoyed. They drank and were refreshed. But then God spoke to Moses and Aaron alone. And he said, "Because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore shall ye not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them." Well, the hearts of the old men sank. They had indeed made a grave mistake. And now, not to go into Canaan after all they had done for Israel, all of the trials they'd endured, but because they had not precisely obeyed God, they had spoiled something very beautiful, and they'd ruined the most important lesson that God wanted to teach, not only to Israel, but to the people of all the world. Poor Moses and Aaron. Maybe they didn't understand all this as we do now. But God did not blame them for failing to understand. He blamed them for failure to believe and to obey. For 80 years, Moses had dreamed about going into the land of Canaan. And finally, after many years, the children of Israel had arrived at the Jordan River, and across it they could see Jericho and the mountains beyond. And once more, Moses gathered the children of Israel together, and he related to them again the wonderful story reminding them of the way that God had sent food and water and given them victory. God had been a father to them, helping them in every time of need. And then Moses told the people that he was going to leave them, that his time had come to die, and that God had chosen Joshua to lead them into the promised land. When the meeting was over, the people were streaming back into their tents. Some were weeping, others probably talking about Joshua and the kind of a leader that he would make. Slowly through the darkening twilight moves the figure of a lonely man. His work is done. His last command has been given. His last farewell has been said. And now he climbs to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, to meet the one whom he has served so faithfully and so long. With the dawn, Moses looks down upon the camp of the people that he's loved so much, and his eyes roam across the Jordan Valley, westward and northward and southward. There it is, the beautiful land, the goodly land. For a moment, it's all spread out before him in one glorious panorama. How well worth all the struggle and all the toil and all the waiting. And that is the last thing Moses sees on earth. The mission which he set out to accomplish has been completed. And the old eyes close, and Moses falls asleep.
We should be sure to visit. Then he introduced us to wildlife officer Jewett Hall, who would guide us to those places. It's a matter of record that men have gone into the Okefenokee never to be seen again, and there are even legends of lost tribes. So we were mighty happy to be in the company of this man who carried a road map in his head. Passing through a hidden entrance, we moved into the intricate maze of narrow water trails that wind through the cavernous swamp. The dark waters reflect towering stands of age-old cypress decked in Spanish moss. Blankets of water lilies lie on the surface, and the edges are fringed with iris, ferns, canes, and grasses. It's a fairyland jungle, a place of rare beauty and quiet mystery. This is one of the last great strongholds of the alligator. Here he is the king of beasts, fearing no animal and feared by nearly all. A gray fox is asking for trouble when he enters these waters, and trouble is never far away. This fellow got out just in time. Our first glimpse of a bear was a foretaste of an adventure in store for us later. One of the real dangers in traveling through the swamp is the water moccasin, who often suns himself on low overhanging branches. We wanted to catch this one, and because he's extremely poisonous, great care must be taken in handling him. Opening his mouth reveals his deadly fangs, hinged to his upper jaw, and show the distinctive white lining that gives him his common name, Cottonmouth. With its brownish color and dark crossbands, the cottonmouth closely resembles the common water snake, which is harmless. But unless you really know your snakes, I'd recommend you don't take any chances.
Traveling through the Okefenokee, just when you've accustomed yourself to the jungle darkness, you round the bend and find yourself in another world, a world of wide open marshland. Although these grassy areas are called prairies, they're mighty wet prairies. Water flows across at a depth of from 1 to 4 feet, except where the bottom rises here and there to form islands, known as houses or hammocks. Across the prairies, standing out in sharp contrast against the dark forest, are the magnificent winged fishermen of the swamp. Here in safety, the American egret can display the regal plumage for which he was once hunted so savagely. The Okefenokee is a happy hunting ground, not only for the zoologist, but for the botanist as well. Many rare plants have been discovered here, including one that bears the nickname soap plant. Naturally, we had to test it. You have to be careful where you wash your hands in these parts. In the early days, it was the only soap the Indians of the swamp had. It really cleaned. It looked as though my splashing had frightened a raccoon out of the water. But I was not the real cause of his concern. As a result of all this commotion, a big bull gator suddenly started to bellow, asserting his claim over his territory. And he was answered all across the swamp.
Okefenokee, you can never be sure that what appears to be solid ground is really solid. Much of the vegetation, even the trees, are not in contact with the ground at all, but are rooted in the floating upper crust of the peat bed. Hence the name Land of Quaking Earth. Of course, I had to try it out.
And I soon found out why the long pole is standard equipment here for pedestrians.
The Okefenokee contains the headwaters of the famous Suwannee River, which carries most of its waters out to the Gulf of Mexico. Unlike some swamps in which the water is stagnant, the Okefenokee contains pure water that flows slowly but continuously across the open prairies, through the dense forests, along alligator trails, and twisting watercourses. Here and there, an island rises out of the water, and on one of the larger islands, we established our camp. With us here was swamper Johnny Hickok, chief guide of Okefenokee Swamp Park. Johnny was a walking library of swamp lore. One of his tales concerned a secret island in the swamp said to be the most blissful spot on earth. Unfortunately, he didn't know where it was. So Jim and I set off separately to explore the island we were on. I stopped at a quiet inlet and before long spotted a fox squirrel named for his bushy, fox-like tail. This is the largest tree squirrel in the United States. He must be pretty hungry because this is the first time I ever saw a fox squirrel eat a lily pad. Next, I saw a family of mallard ducks. Now, ducks and a squirrel pose no problem in peaceful coexistence. But when a bobcat enters the scene, that's different. Place to escape from a hungry bobcat. But the water has its problems too. Now the bobcat goes back to chasing the ducks, and this is his fatal mistake.
On the other end of the island, I found a paradise for birds, a rookery alive with cattle egrets, American egrets, and little blue herons. Swamps are favorite haunts of such wading birds. They're all spearfishers, hunting in the shallow waters and returning to the nests and the rookeries. I was able to move right up on two American egrets. They were young ones and still at the awkward age, not yet expert in flying. On close examination, I could see that they would soon leave the nest. While they're still young, this is an ideal sanctuary. They can stay beyond the reach of predators by perching in the bushes, using their wings as well as their legs to move about and spread their weight. Besides, I can testify from personal experience that it's mighty difficult for any predator to get in through that brush, water, and mud.
Few people came calling at our camp in the swamp, so we were anticipating excitement as we stood by to greet Warden Johnston of the Georgia Game and Fish Commission. When he explained his mission, we were all eager to join forces with him. The problem was a bear that had taken to living near the edge of the swamp, quite close to a town. Too close for the safety of the townspeople or the bear. If he left the refuge, he was liable to be shot. Johnstone had located the bear. Our assignment now was to help capture him and relocate the bear far back inside the swamp. Our plan was to drive the bear up a tree and rope him there. But when we came out into a small lake, what we saw made us quickly change our strategy. The bear was in the water, and if we tried to run him ashore, we'd lose him. The only thing to do was to try to lasso him from the boat. When there's only one rope on a bear, you don't have him, he's got you. So to control him, I had to put a second rope on him. Doubts about the strength of a bear, they were ended that day. Even with two outboards working for us, the bear could outpull us. What we needed was a foothold. So once we'd maneuvered him into shallow water, we had to abandon the boat and use our own muscles to pull him ashore. Justison had already deposited a bear cage in the general area. It didn't take long for him and Johnny Hickok to go and get it, but it seemed long to those of us who were left holding the bear. We estimated the weight of this male bear to be about 350 pounds, and that he was about 3 years old. It was all we could do to hold the bear near the cage. Finally, he decided it was safer inside than out. To support the weight of the bear and cage, two boats had been lashed together as a catamaran to give the required stability. Our route of travel had to be carefully charted because moving a caged bear through the narrow swamp trails of the Okefenokee is a difficult task. Building up the bear population is one of the long-range conservation goals of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So our job now was to select a large island in the interior of the swamp that would be a good habitat for bears, providing good cover and plenty of food. After much searching, we found a suitable island. But at first, the bear was cautious about entering his new home. But once he got ashore, he set a new track record. We waited to see if he would adjust to his new habitat.
It didn't take long for him to start ripping up the landscape to get at bark and pulp and other favorite delicacies. Following the bear, we covered a good part of the island. He had several encounters with other animals that already lived there. The first one he met was a young red-shouldered hawk who had just learned to fly. To an alligator, it was a different story. Take care of themselves. And when predators meet, there's bound to be a conflict. Now, a bobcat may think a young alligator is an easy victim, but a young alligator is one of the scrappiest animals there is. Another real fighter is the snapping turtle. At the approach of a water moccasin, most turtles would retreat inside their shells, but not the snapper. For him, the water moccasin is a potential meal. The fangs of the snake and the powerful jaws of the turtle are both lethal weapons. Snake strikes a vital spot, and they're locked in a grip of death.
The one animal on the island that usually comes out best in any encounter is the skunk, thanks to his experience with chemical warfare. He doesn't need to back up from anyone, as our bear soon found out. And he adds insult to injury by splashing water in the bear's face. encounter with the skunk didn't affect the bear's sense of smell because it wasn't long until he found a tree filled with honey. This is his favorite food. Finding it is a good indication that he will successfully adapt to his new home in this magnificent land of quaking earth.
Oh, Church?
No, we didn't get home about 25 minutes to 8, so I wouldn't go rushing down there.
I don't know if I've had any night. I heard a few cars go by.
Well, I just didn't worry about it. I was tired.
I bet you do. I don't blame you. I wouldn't either. The folks don't go when they want to do something else.
Y'all had a good trip?
Yeah, we had a good trip. We come back through Gainesville. Mary thought she'd go stop at Louis and we'd get a hamburger, but they're closed. I imagine they close early or maybe close all day on Sunday. I don't know.
Well, we went in that store a while. Then we stopped at Stark and got something to eat.
I think she kind of wanted to stop at Stark, but she decided she'd go on to Gainesville. I'm glad she didn't stop anywhere, because I don't care too much about that kind of stuff at night. Mm-hmm.
It was nice, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sure was.
Bunch of people came and went.
Yeah, a lot of them, I think, was firemen.
Mm-hmm.
Did Ibbins enjoy it?
Yeah, I think so.
I know he did. He acted mm-hmm. like it.
Yeah, I think
so. I called up to Sun and Glory's, and Nancy answered and said that they were keeping Liam.
I guess they had gone to see the baby.
I figured that's where they'd gone. I told her, well, I didn't want nothing. I just wanted to tell them I was home.
Well, I don't know how Lynn got them to Sunday school this morning, but Pat and Nancy was both at Sunday school. I figured they'd get on the good side of
them. That's it?
Huh?
That's exactly it. I figured that tonight when, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, so they were both at Sunday school.
Was Florence there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad that Carla was there.
No, I don't believe Carla was there.
Down?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, they're not in their class.
They're not? Well, who's Nancy and Patty in?
They stay back there in that other class, back there in the back. Dean and Donna and them.
My goodness gracious. They look like they ought to be, look like Nancy at these
times. They haven't been there so long, but I don't really know what class they're
in. Well, I bet you're pretty. That's just the idea.
Yeah.
Well, can't help that.
Well, Miss Johnson enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think she did, but I think she'd like to have something to eat when we're coming home. But, of course, you know she don't never have nothing. But I declare that, Lane, if she ain't a bird, she never got up, and she never offered to fix them a cup of coffee or do a thing in the world. Mary asked her mama if she wanted a cup of coffee and said she wouldn't mind it. She went in and fixed her and her mama a cup of coffee. She said she knew I didn't drink it. Mary didn't want to know if I wanted a Coke, and I told her no, I didn't believe I did. And after a while, Lynn said, well, I was going to cook dinner for y'all, but after Neil and Sally left, I decided I wouldn't do it. I thought, well, are you sure about this? Beats all I've ever seen.
What time did y'all get there?
About, we left here at 11:30. Got there about 1:30.
Well, I'll let you go. I just want to see if you're all right.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to go to bed pretty soon.
I am, too. I can't find nothing to look at. That old Ed Sullivan, that old black nigger up there, and I left him.
Ain't nothing on there no better than the nigger was.
No, ain't nothing on the thing.
Well, I'll see you.
Okay. Well, listen, Louise said that Sulane was still moving.
Yeah, she told me.
I wasn't going to tell my bunch nothing about that, but Warren got over there and told her.
Oh, he did.
I wonder why he had to tell that.
What all did he tell?
I don't know what he told, but I know Lane said, well, I declare, I didn't know Sue Lane was moving out till Warren told me today.
Well, that's all right. It's nothing to that, her moving with Sue's ring.
Well, I just wanted to wait till they got fixed and everything. Louise said she hated my bed to put that little baby to sleep over there and leave it.
Mm-hmm.
I told you she said it was taking steps.
Yeah, but she said she never was glad to get rid of nothing as she was too late.
Oh, my Lord. She ought to, I'm going to slap her in the mouth if you don't hush.
Well, I don't think she said it to her, but I don't reckon she did.
No, I think they're in a very good humor. So Miss Johnson just thought it was terrible. I said, Miss Johnson, I said, stop and think. I said, that's a house full. I mean full. And I said, if Sue Lane could move in with Sue's Ree, and they could be happy over there, and Carol take care of that baby in the afternoons when Sue Lane goes to work, I said, it's much better than it is, like it is now. Oh, mercy, I hate that. What in the world? I said, well, I don't agree with you. I said, I think it's the thing to do.
I do too.
I said, anyway, I'm going to tell you something. Sue Lane is old enough to get out and get her own apartment, much less with one of Sue's Ree. You know, Louise and Sue's Ree, of course, they stayed with y'all, but my stars, they wasn't over 17, 18 years old when they went to Jacksonville.
No, Sue Lane's 22,
ain't she? Yeah?
21.
Mm-hmm.
Will be.
Well, I hope it's going to work out. I don't know.
I hope so, too.
Lord knows I do. Well, so you tired?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was real nice, but old Raymond, he was right cute. He said,
yeah,
doggone.
Yeah, I think he was enjoying it.
I know it was. He said, I wish I was hearing it to know. He's going to wish he wasn't, and he looked at his garden up there. Looks to me like it's killed.
They said they'd be back Tuesday.
Jane said it said 32 in the morning, and then gonna be real cold the next morning.
Well, she didn't go, did she?
No, she said Fred didn't feel good, and that she got aggravated. She just quit trying to do anything about it. I really think Jane would have loved to have gone. As she said, he had to study, and he couldn't go with them. And Freddie wouldn't go. Listen, yes, she said that they went up to Gilbert to see him. And they told him that they had taken Mr. Gilbert up and had him in a wheelchair.
They did that yesterday.
And they had been feeding him. Did they tell you they'd been feeding him?
No, they didn't.
They had been feeding him by mouth, and he vomited it up. And the nurse said, well, don't worry about that. That's perfectly all right. Said, I just fed him too much. Said, I'll give him some more in a little while. And they were kind of hope up over what Jane said.
Well, they had to tie him in the thing.
Huh?
They had to tie him in the thing, in the wheelchair.
Well?
To keep him, you know, from...
Oh, yeah. Well, he's, I guess if he can sit in that wheelchair, they'll start that old therapy. You know... They had just given Miss Patterson therapy, I think, when she come back and had that spell.
No, they were giving it to her.
Oh, were they giving it?
The woman was working with a leg in the bed.
Oh. Well, I knew there's something about therapy.
Well, I told Miss Gilbert this morning, I said ours couldn't move hers, and they gave her.
No! And they said, of course, they know that he's paralyzed, he can't talk, and they said, well, keep talking to him.
Yeah, well, Miss Gilbert said the doctors plainly told him that he'd never be right in the head again. Mm-hmm. His mind won't never be right.
Good Scott.
And they think that might play a part, that if he knew what they were, you know, if he could react like a normal person.
Yeah, they said that they
But his mind might be so bad that he can't.
Told him, says, just keep talking to him. Jane says, they said, well, he just can't talk. He just can't talk. Jane says, I started telling him, I know some can't talk, too.
Yeah.
Let's go. Well.
That's right.
Okay.
I hope you'll be better.
I doubt that thing.
I do, too. Well, I'll see you. Bye.
Okay, bye.
In Jacksonville, or did you go by?
Well, no, I didn't go by.
Uh-huh.
Louise and Warren was at the thing.
Oh, were they?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Sue Lane was moving.
Oh, was she?
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did Louise and Warren say all right?
Well, they said that Sue went back. I told you, didn't I, that she went back to hospital for another week.
No, you didn't tell me that.
Well, that's what they told. They called me last night and talked to me,
uh-huh.
Louise and Sue. The doctor wouldn't let her. He said that he let her out all day yesterday, and she went and got her hair fixed and bought her something and so on, but he said she just couldn't go back to work in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to stay at the hospital till that part of the week, and then maybe she'd be able to go to work next week.
Uh-huh.
How'd Lynn get along while you was gone?
Fine.
Hey, Chief, take a peek, wouldn't you?
Uh-huh, they're well and gone an hour and a half.
How's the baby?
Fine.
What's his name?
Adria Elizabeth. We were only gone an hour and a half.
I thought maybe that's what you're going, where you're going. Nancy didn't tell me, but I thought it was.
Yeah,
I told Nancy it wanted to know. I said, well, I didn't want nothing on, just tell them I was home.
She won't speak to you.
Okay.
Grandma.
Uh-huh.
In the morning, Elvis will have a call. Can you come to my house? We'll be right home. And Mom will tell me the magic.
Great Scott, I see you. I see you in the morning here.
Okay.
I probably nice to see you now.
She's wound up, isn't she?
Hey, Lord, what she's wearing. I ain't gonna get her sleep.
I don't know.
You may have to give her some. Woo! Great Scott.
Well, Steve and Jim came over here just before we got here.
Who did?
Tim and Steven.
Uh-huh.
Came over just before we got here.
Uh-huh.
And she wound up for him. But, and so, Susan really did go back for another week.
Yes. He said that, I think she got back to Best Doctor in Jacksonville.
Uh-huh.
And he said, and then she called Newton, told him that she thought she was going to get out. He said, I done told you, Steve, that you got well. And said, you just go right ahead. He said, quit piling all that work on Susan. I don't think she'd do that. Well, Louis said she hated my bed, put that little baby to sleep over to Sue Lane, over to Susie's apartment, see?
Oh, she put her to sleep there?
Yeah.
But she thinks it's for the best, huh?
Yes, she does. She still thinks so.
Well, is Sue Lane and the baby going to stay there by themselves now until Susie?
I think Jimmy's going to stay there till long. Yeah, but Jimmy's going to stay.
Oh, he's
going to stay? Uh-huh, till Susie comes in.